The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting the latest vision news. Today's vision news is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937, by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. First up, from coolblindtech.com, the WHO launches the Who Eyes app on World Sight Day, dateline October 13th. Vision loss affects people of all ages, with at least 2.2 billion globally having near or distance vision impairment. World Sight Day, observed every second Thursday of October, highlights the global impact of blindness and vision impairment. To mark this year's World Sight Day, the World Health Organization, WHO, introduces the Who Eyes app. This free app allows the general public to assess their vision for both close-up and distance viewing, providing crucial insights into potential vision issues. The app checks visual acuity, a key measure of the eye's ability to discern shapes and details at a given distance. Early identification of vision impairment is crucial, and Who Eyes aims to raise awareness and encourage regular vision checks. Who Eyes app can help identify potential vision issues quickly. It complements regular eye checks by professionals, emphasizing the importance of proactive eye care, said Dr. Bente, B-E-N-T-E, Mickelson, M-I-K-K-E-L-S-E-N, WHO Director for Non-Communicable Diseases. Available in all six UN languages, Arabic, Chinese, English, French, Russian, and Spanish, the Who Eyes app can be downloaded for free on both the Apple App Store and Google Play. From CPR.org comes an article by Michelle P. Fulcher, F-U-L-C-H-E-R. Interview: This blind historian has set out to share the history of Colorado's visually impaired communities. Blind people have been politicians and business professionals, artisans, and community activists throughout Colorado's history, but their stories have gone largely untold. Historian Peggy Chong wants to change that. Chong is known as the Blind History Lady for her research into the personalities and challenges of visually impaired communities in Colorado and elsewhere. She recently won a grant from the National Federation of the Blind to continue those efforts. Chong said many blind people lose their sight after they become adults. They struggle with how to adapt, and neither they nor the counselors who are paid to help them have role models to serve as examples. Blind people are studied for our medical conditions always, but we're rarely studied for what we have accomplished, she said. Chong spoke to Colorado Matters host Chandra Thomas Whitfield about the history of legislation and access in Colorado for visually impaired communities and prominent blind people in the state's history, including a governor. Chandra Thomas Whitfield: I understand one of Colorado's governors was actually legally blind, and that would be Elias Ammons, A-M-M-O-N-S, who served from 1913 to 1915. Peggy Chong: That is correct. He contracted measles when he was a teenager, and when he recovered, one of the side effects from the measles was that his vision was becoming less and less. He wanted to be a newspaper man, but did not think that with his vision loss he would be able to do that. So we went into ranching instead. On his ranch, he was confronted with several issues that ranchers were dealing with: railroads coming through, cattle rustling, and all sorts of things. He was really good at getting up at meetings and speaking about what he thought was important for the ranchers, addressing it with the current state legislators and so on. So his community elected him to be a state representative. Then he became a state senator. And then in 1913, he was elected governor of the state of Colorado. How do you think his vision problems might have influenced some of the causes he took on and some of the things he accomplished? It wasn't until the last part of his life that he actually addressed vision issues, and that was probably because he did not know a lot of blind people at that time. When he became governor, that's when he really started to know of other blind persons. A man named James Downing was elected to the State House of Representatives in 1916. The two of them also met Luke Wilcox, who was a blind man who ran his own magazine, Field and Farm. He had a printing company, a public relations company, and they got together and started talking about the needs of blind adults, those going blind later in life, who wanted to learn how to get back out into the job world and needed additional techniques, such as learning how to read and write in an alternative format. And so it was when Ammons joined up with other folks that he started to work on crafting state legislation that ultimately passed in 1918 that created a commission for the blind, created benefits that were across the board, the same for blind people. So it wasn't until later on, most of his focus for many years was on equal rights for women. His sister was very active in women's movements, and he took a lot of energy from her in that regard. Interviewer, another person you've learned a lot about is Jenny Coward Jackson. She was instrumental in getting jobs for blind people in Colorado in the early 1900s. How did that come about? She was kind of a spitfire. She had gone to the school for the blind in Kansas, and when she moved to Colorado about 1903, she found basically a wasteland of services for blind people. There was nothing, so she started to seek out other blind people. They began working on legislation to start a workshop for the blind. It took a few years, but Colorado Industries for the Blind finally became a reality. She began teaching there. The people coming to Colorado Industries for the Blind had no skills at all. They were people being abandoned by their family or in poor houses. With her efforts demonstrating that she could teach, that she could get people ready for work outside of a workshop, she became the first traveling teacher for blind people in the state. She spent her wages on travel because she didn't have a travel budget. She spent her wages on purchasing slates and styluses, which is the equivalent of a pencil and paper for blind people. She started braille classes. She started weaving classes. Every one of her classes, she had them learn to read and write in New York Point. There's no reading materials, so they would write up an essay or a short story, and they would pass it to the next one to correct it, but also to reinforce their reading. And they accumulated, if you will, their own little libraries in these reading groups. Wow! So you've done this research for many years and even picked up the nickname the Blind History Lady. Why do you think it's important to tell these stories? I grew up in the blind community. I had a mother who was legally blind as well, and I have sisters who are blind as well. I knew the old rug weavers and the piano tuners and the door-to-door salesmen, and I felt sort of ashamed of them when I was a teenager because they were doing these low-level, low-paid jobs. And as a teenager in the blind community, I was beginning to meet blind lawyers and blind teachers and blind businessmen. And I did not understand why they were just taking these low-level jobs. But these were blind people that were supporting their families, raising children, and sending them to college. They were groundbreaking at the time. When I was in my late 20s, I was given a job to clean out the files at the Home for the Blind in Minnesota. It was closing. There were file cabinets and boxes of old records and letters and newsletters and all kinds of things. While I was going through those files, I learned of our blind senator. I didn't know there was a blind senator from Minnesota, and that's what got me started. And once I learned how to do family genealogy, my research really expanded with what I now call our blind ancestors. So it sounds like a lot of this for you was to inspire others who are visually impaired, but also to raise awareness for those outside of the community about many contributions that those who are blind have contributed to our society. Absolutely. When a person goes blind later in life, and most people go blind in their working years, they think they're the only one who's ever been a blind banker or a blind judge or a blind business owner, and that is so not the case. When they go to many of the counselors, social workers, rehabilitation professionals, they are told, "Geez, I don't think a blind person's ever done that. Here, why don't you go into vending?" Not that there's anything wrong with becoming an operator of a vending stand, but if you'd really like to be a banker, why don't you go into banking? And there have been blind bankers in this country. The reason those rehab professionals don't tell you that is because they don't know. It's not taught in their college courses. Blind people are studied for our medical conditions always, but we're rarely studied for what we have accomplished. To know our history, it is important to have role models. You talked about being ashamed, having your mother being visually impaired. Can you tell us a little bit about depression and those feelings of embarrassment and anxiety in the community? I wanted to be like everybody else. I want to be the same as my next door neighbor. I don't want to be considered the blind lady down the block. I didn't want to be considered the blind mother when I had my child. I wanted to be considered my daughter's mother. I wanted to be considered as the person who showed up and worked for the Parent Teacher Association. I wanted to be considered a valuable part of my community. Because we don't have role models and we don't have people to teach us some of these cute little skills that help you to mix or to help you get into a sighted crowd, it's really hard and it's difficult to feel like you're wanted. I was telling a blind man one time how I was having difficulty navigating the PTA meeting, and he said, well, what I do is get a cup of coffee and start walking around, and people start talking to you right away because they don't want you to spill that cup of coffee on them. So they start talking to you and wanting to have you find a chair, and that's when you say, oh, that's okay, I don't mind standing, and who are you? And it really did help, just that little icebreaker. Yeah, and I think this is important because I think sometimes just in any community, you sometimes forget about things like people who may be the only or the first in a situation, someone who's different, and thank you for putting that on the radar for us. So, you recently won the Bulletin Award from the National Federation of the Blind. It's a $5,000 award that goes to individuals who are considered a positive force in the lives of blind people. What will that award allow you to do? I'm excited. I have found a Harman Foundation project in the Library of Congress files that awarded blind people a financial award. I don't know a lot about this award, but it was from 1928 to 1932. What was interesting to me about this foundation is that it primarily focused on promoting black artists. And why did they switch to blind folks? Many of those people whose names I recognized in the list of people they considered for the awards were white. So I have all these questions. I'm hoping to find in these files biographies, the careers that some of these folks had, maybe even some photographs, and tell those stories because these people were not the Helen Kellers or the Stevie Wonders or Ray Charles. These were broom makers. These were people who made a living selling rugs, who taught piano to the neighborhood kids. So what was the criteria? I don't know, and I'm very excited to find out. Wow, it sounds like you have a lot of work to do, but we'll have to hear what you've come up with. I'd love to share. Historians have to trek through lots of records, and you're legally blind yourself. How have you navigated this work? Everything is not on the web. A lot of it is in boxes, in basements, and is being forgotten, like the records we had here in Colorado. They were in handwritten form. Some of them were moldy. Some of them the ink had bled. Some of them were faded, water damaged. What we did with those records, because I couldn't read most of that stuff, we digitized all of those records. So we created a digital file. But that does not mean that they're accessible. We had each of those records scanned with an optical character recognition, and even the old files that were typed, the files do not allow you to grab hold of that text because it's in an old font, not recognized by the optical character recognition. So thanks to COVID, we were able to recruit more than 100 volunteers who took an enormous amount of time and re-entered all of those into a Word or text file so that a screen reader or a Braille translation program could access the actual text and convert it into either audio or Braille output. So that's one way of doing it. I make a lot of phone calls, and I sometimes have to make a few donations to genealogical societies or museums to go out and do a little legwork for me and send me back a file or two. It sounds like what you did is created access, which was the key word there. It's creating more access to people, yourself included. And those files are now accessible to anybody, even if you don't live in the United States, as we are putting them up on the Colorado Virtual Library that can be accessed from their website. Historically, how would you say Colorado has ranked compared to other states in terms of the rights and services available to blind people? Kind of depends on the time frame or what issue you're focusing on. We had a school for the blind earlier than some states. However, we didn't have any adult services of any consequence, really, until about the 1940s. Blind people were organized here in Colorado, met and shared ideas, acted as their own social services and their own agency, but had limited resources to do that. The blind people who were from other parts of the country brought into that collective the names, addresses of other blind people from out of state that they could call on and say, hey, tell me about that law that you guys passed. That's how our first white cane law got passed, is because we borrowed that from California. What is a white cane law? The white cane law allows a blind person to travel independently without the fear of being told that if an accident happens, you shouldn't have been out there anyway. It says to the driver that when you see a white cane, you're supposed to slow down and yield. It provides protection that if you're hit by a car, that you still do have the right, if that person was impaired as a driver or driving recklessly, that you still have the right to sue that person or have charges brought against them, rather than saying, well, the blind person shouldn't have been out on the road anyway, which still happens from time to time. What are a couple of needs for the blind community now here in Colorado? Transportation is always a big issue. We have really large issue in the metropolitan area, but also getting to other parts of the state. It's very difficult to the western slope if you're a blind person and you do not have a car. I think we still need to have a lot of education amongst the blind community, amongst employers, amongst legislators, that blind people are capable of doing every job out there, just about every job, and that we should be given a chance, that we should not just be passed over because we're a blind person, because you don't think you could as a blind person. It matters that we think we can as a blind person, and we should be given the chance to demonstrate whether we can or cannot do our job. You care. You want to know what's really going on these days, especially in Colorado? We can help you keep up. The Lookout is a free daily email newsletter with news and happenings from all over Colorado. Sign up here and we will see you in the morning. From experiencelife.lifetime.life. Pumping irony. Seeing is believing. I arrived at my eye doctor's office the other day with the same sort of blurry ambivalence that typically characterizes these visits. You may know the drill. Answer some benign questions about your general health. Squint through various optical lenses while trying to read small print on the eye chart. Submit to the drops that dilate your eyes for closer examination and exit wearing a pair of sunglasses. Unless you're struggling with some serious vision issues, it can seem like a waste of time. It appears I'm not the only senior who holds this view. If recent research is any indication, my contemporaries and I share a particularly puzzling approach to eye health. Many of us fear losing our sight more than any other affliction, yet we tend to turn a blind eye toward the various screenings and treatments that reliably prevent its occurrence. The results of a study released in June by the nonprofit Prevent Blindness found that 1 in 4 respondents 55 and older who were at risk for retinal diseases had delayed seeking appropriate care. Those results mirror the findings of a 2018 University of Michigan AARP poll, reporting that nearly 1 in 5 older adults hadn't seen an eye doctor for 3 years or more. There is significantly less of an emphasis placed on eye health than there is on general health. Rohit Varma, MD, MPH, founding director of the Southern California Eye Institute, tells Kaiser Health News. Because vision impairment is gradual and generally painless, Varma explains seniors are prone to overlook its implications. People get used to it, and as they age, they begin to feel, oh, this is a normal part of aging, and it's okay. But cataracts, which can cause blindness, aren't okay. And they are endemic among people 75 and older, affecting about half of that age group nationwide. And macular degeneration carries similar risks while afflicting some 20 million Americans over the age of 40. Another 10 million struggle with diabetic retinopathy, and about 3 million more suffer from glaucoma. It's not that older adults intentionally ignore these vision problems. There are accessibility issues as well. Traditional Medicare doesn't cover eye care, and coverage by Advantage plans is sketchy at best. Just because people know they need care doesn't necessarily mean that they can afford it or that they have access to it, notes Prevent Blindness CEO Jeff Todd. And it seldom comes up when seniors visit their physicians. Nearly 6 in 10 of those polled in the University of Michigan AARP survey reported that their doctors hadn't inquired about their vision at their regular medical appointments. That's not surprising when you consider that many seniors arrive with myriad chronic illnesses, and doctors often consult under duress. But Joshua Ehrlich, MD, MPH, an assistant professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences at UM Health Kellogg Eye Center, argues that physicians could work more closely with eye care specialists when treating patients whose conditions, such as diabetes, threaten their eyesight as well as their overall health. Such a collaboration could help establish a clearer connection between our vision and our well-being. After all, as Allison Bryant, PhD, former Senior Vice President of Research at AARP, puts it, vision loss affects an older adult's overall health, risk of falling, social interactions, and quality of life. And as I learned the other day from my eye doctor, physiological changes can impact our vision in ways we may not understand. He displayed an image from inside my eye and explained how he would need to monitor the blood vessels there as a result of my recent hypertensive crisis. Chronically high blood pressure, he explained, can more than damage my heart. It could mess with my eyesight as well. This was news to me. My regular doctor hadn't mentioned such a risk. So I left my eye doctor's office after promising to return in 6 months to revisit those blood vessels and my slowly emerging cataracts, while continuing to take my blood pressure medications. It was, I had to admit, a pretty eye-opening session. From Cool Blind Tech, posted September 18th, Recreation Adaptive Society breaks barriers with free accessibility device trials. In a heartwarming and inclusive initiative, the nonprofit organization known as the Recreation Adaptive Society in Victoria recently opened its doors to the community, inviting people of all abilities to experience the joy of accessible outdoor activities at Clover Point. This exceptional event, aptly named the Adaptive Bike Fest, aimed to demonstrate that getting outdoors can be a shared experience, even for those with limited mobility. What sets this event apart is its provision of an invaluable opportunity for people to try out expensive accessibility devices, such as adaptive bikes, without any financial commitment. At the heart of this inspiring endeavor is Tenel Bolt, the founder of the Recreation Adaptive Society. Tenel's journey toward creating this nonprofit organization was born out of her own life-altering experience. In 2015, she endured a harrowing free-jumping accident from an 18-meter, 60-foot bridge, resulting in a severe spinal cord injury that left her paraplegic. Tenel's post-injury life opened her eyes to the myriad barriers that people with disabilities face when attempting to engage in outdoor activities. Her personal struggle became a catalyst for change, inspiring her to establish the Recreation Adaptive Society. She is determined to raise awareness not only among individuals with disabilities, but also within the able-bodied community. One of the Society's core missions is to provide a diverse inventory of adapted outdoor recreation equipment available for low-cost rentals. This essential service allows individuals to access specialized devices without the financial burden that often accompanies purchasing such equipment. The Adaptive Bike Fest is a testament to their commitment, offering attendees the chance to try out these life-changing devices for free. The event's success goes beyond the provision of equipment. It represents a broader message of inclusion, breaking down societal barriers, and fostering a community where everyone can participate in the joys of outdoor recreation. Tenel Bolt's dedication to making the outdoors accessible to all serves as an inspiration and a call to action. For those who wish to support this noble cause, whether through equipment rentals or donations, the Recreation Adaptive Society has made it easy. Simply visit their website and explore the various ways in which you can contribute to this impactful organization. By doing so, you become part of a movement that seeks to transform outdoor recreation into an inclusive and accessible experience for everyone, regardless of their physical abilities. Join in on this journey toward a more inclusive and accessible outdoor world where barriers are replaced with bridges and everyone can savor the freedom of the great outdoors. From fightingblindness.org, we have Finding the Keys to the Kingdom in their Beacon Stories. Tricia Wechter, W-A-E-C-H-T-E-R, is the founder and CEO of Blind Girl Designs. Choosing this name for her business was obvious, as she's proud of her blindness. Another integral part of Tricia's vision loss journey is her white cane, and she wants to help normalize the use of white canes. Tricia was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, RP, in the early 2000s after failing her visual field test several times at a routine eye doctor's appointment. She went to a retina specialist who was hesitant to tell her the diagnosis because he didn't want to say that there was no treatment or cure. After being diagnosed, Tricia's family members were all genetically tested and discovered that her two sisters and niece also have RP. They've all found it difficult to accept their RP diagnosis, but the shared experiences have been helpful in their journey of coping. Tricia's RP has progressed significantly in recent years, with her peripheral vision declining rapidly. In April of 2011, when Tricia and her family were visiting Knott's Berry Farm, she suddenly experienced the children all disappearing from her line of sight. She quickly discovered an organization nearby, the San Diego Center for the Blind, where they measured her for a white cane and gave her a brief orientation and mobility training. After that, she would go to YouTube for how-to videos from orientation and mobility instructors, which she found to be an incredibly useful resource. "They launched me on such an incredible journey with my white canes," says Tricia. "I didn't realize how much I was faking it. But once I had the cane, it was like the keys to the kingdom. It just unlocked everything and resolved so many of my issues with mobility." In 2018, Tricia started using a white cane full-time after her visual field went from about 20 degrees to 11 degrees in 2 years. Due to this, Tricia had to leave her corporate job in fashion, where she traveled to all 7 continents and 48 countries, projecting fashion trends for years. After working in New York City for over 20 years, Tricia and her family moved to Houston, Texas, for what she thought was a temporary job. But after realizing she couldn't get another job in her field due to her vision loss, she started filling her time by helping a friend who owned a small factory in the area. When designers would visit the factory, they'd typically meet in a conference room, so her white cane was usually under the table. But one day, one of her clients asked her to come see their factory, and she knew it wasn't safe for her to visit without her white cane. But her friend didn't want the client to know she was blind, so she didn't take her white cane and held his arm instead. But after the visit, Tricia felt so angry with this idea that her white cane was a problem. "The fact is that I'm blind, and I was not okay with that rejection of my white cane," recalls Tricia. "I decided then that I'm not ashamed of my blindness, and I'm not going to hide my white cane in any situation. There's nothing to be ashamed of when using a white cane, and shame is no way to feel just because you're visually impaired." After that experience, Tricia stopped working with her friend, and on the first day of 2021, Tricia decided that she was going to start her own company. "I have the brain, the experience, and I know how to build a clothing line. So why not start my own company?" said Tricia. "And I knew it was going to be called Blind Girl Designs because that's what I am, and I'm proud of who I am." Tricia's family have all been huge supporters of her vision loss journey and dreams, which is why Blind Girl Designs has evolved into a family business. Tricia's niece, Molly Casey, created the website, while she and Tricia's son, Robert, were the first models of the apparel. Robert and Tricia's husband, Tom, helped with the designs, deliveries, and the conventions they showcase at almost every weekend. By the end of April 2021, Blind Girl Designs had the full online storefront set up, including extensive detailed descriptions of all their products. A few months later, another blind entrepreneur, Laura Legendary, who founded a jewelry company called Elegant Insights, found Blind Girl Designs through social media and contacted Tricia about being part of her Let's Go Shopping event. Since the event was leading up to the holidays, Tricia knew they had to create holiday apparel to sell. So she laid out all her white canes on the ground and played with them until she came up with a snowflake design. That was her first design. And there's more, but I've run out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.